Intermediate Court of Appeals is now in session. The Honorable Dan R. Foley, Craig H. Nakamura, and the presiding.
Be seated, please.
Please be seated. Case number 27329, Juanita Garza, CMS 1 for Incorporated. Will Edelman for appellant, Paul Yamamura for appellant. Are you on the merits?
Mr. Edelman.
Can I be heard? I was told that there's something that's not quite right with the microphone. Is everything okay? Can
you hear him back there? Okay.
A little soft, though, maybe.
Okay, I'll speak up. Is that better? Okay. I'd like to begin with just a little bit of factual background. The contract that's in dispute in the situation was signed in 1997 between the appellees Soto, Safe and Alarm Company, and Loa'a, who operated the Minute Stop, which is a chain of convenience stores. Now, the store that's in question is about one half a block from the courthouse in Maui and directly across the street from a Chevron station. And they operated a Shell station at that time. It's no longer in business. My client, Ms. Zaragoza, the appellant, was hired approximately 4 or 5 months prior to the event in question. She was first hired as a cashier, and she was told, as all the other female employees, that they basically would work during the day and evening shift, but wouldn't be required to work on the overnight shift graveyard because there were men who were employees who were doing it. By the time, a little bit later, and this would have been maybe a month or so before the event, all of the male employees were either dismissed or left, and so there were only females left. And the women were a little bit worried, and they started to talk and be concerned about why there aren't any security cameras, as the across the street Chevron station had security cameras because they were worried about their safety. But basically what they were told is, don't have to worry about that. We have a hold-up alarm, and they had been trained in how to use it under the counter, and if something were to happen, they would push the button, and the police would be there very promptly. But the police station, the main police station, is approximately half a mile away, and there are cars.
How do you know they would have been there promptly?
Well, because that's what they were told. I'm just reporting what my client was told by the management of Loa.
But the police never told her that.
No,
we're not really certain how soon the police would have been there.
That is correct.
Is there any evidence in the record about response times in locations close to your location in terms of how long it took the police once they were alerted to show up at the location?
Well, there is no direct evidence as to exactly how long it would take. What I'm saying, Your Honors, is that the main police station is approximately half a mile away. And it is, where this was the main business district in Wailuku, which is the county.
Besides that, is the only direct evidence in the record your client's, I guess, testimony in the deposition that she thought 3 or 4 minutes it would take? Is that in terms of the direct evidence on that issue?
Yeah, and in contra to that, Your Honor, it should be noted that the declaration and the evidence and the report done by her, it's not her psychiatrist, but this was the psychiatrist who examined her 3 times, who was the IME physician who was appointed by Loa'a, her employer, basically found that she didn't really have any idea of the time, because he reported that once she was confronted with a gun in her face, everything just slowed down in terms of time. She had really no idea of how long things took. In saying that, she was just guessing.
Are you referring to Dr. Batui?
That's correct.
Okay.
Yes, thank you. Right, just returning to that, so on the date of the event, she had taken her duty station, and after she came in there, now the appellees are making a very major point of the fact that she left the door open. Well, this is a person who was the robber, who's never been found. was actually somebody who had been in there before, and even if it had been locked, she would have let him in because, you know, he's not going to brandish a gun coming into the store. He would take it out from inside. So the fact that that the door was open was not really any major issue here.
The door was locked, but if a customer showed up, they would let him in?
That's correct. Yeah, that's how it worked. I mean, they were trained to, you know, basically observe and to see whether they thought there was any problem. And if there was a problem and they didn't let them in, they would have pushed the alarm button if they thought it was a serious enough matter. So when she was confronted with the gun, and in fact there was testimony that she was asked whether you're pushing anything, and she denied that she was doing it, so she got really nervous and upset. And when finally, after several attempts and nothing was happening, she just basically lost it, you know, and gave him what it was. And she attempted to keep him there as long as possible by engaging in some kind of a dialogue with him. Anyway, he left. And according to Dr. Petrie's report, and in addition to the report of Dr. Rose, she really wasn't able to get out of the house for more than 2 years. She was not able to work. She was not interested in her husband. She kept her son at home.
Is Dr. Rose's report part of the record, counsel?
I believe that there was. I can't say for sure, Your Honor. I don't remember. I'm much more familiar with Dr. B2's report. You know, part of the problem with Dr. Rose is he, about 2 years later, he just left the island, and we haven't been able to really make contact with him.
Any trauma your client suffered was a result of the robbery, wasn't it?
Well, according to the report, and this is very specific, specifically stated by Dr. Bitui, it wasn't from the robbery. It was from the fact that Mrs. Zaragoza had a reasonable expectation and was told and trained to the fact that somebody would be coming right away, and that was her protection, but it never happened, and she suffered the anxiety and the trauma based upon that. That is Dr. Bitui's report, and that was the IME law doctor.
Do we have anything in the record to say that had the alarm system worked, the police would have been there before the robber left?
That's a difficult question to answer because...
That's your burden, right? You're the claimant.
Well, I think that's a question, Your Honor, that should be answered by the trier of fact, not on appeal.
You have to put something forward first. I mean, you have to show causation.
Yeah, well, the causation in part was shown by Dr. B.
Was their top priority for the evening and showed up after the robber left. What difference does it make?
Well, part of the difference, Your Honor, is that and part of the cause, and I think Dr. Bitui talked about this, and certainly my client talked about it afterwards, that is, since the robber wasn't caught at all, that she was afraid that my client was afraid that the robber was going to track her down, find out where she lived, or find her on the street so she wouldn't go outside. And so even if they hadn't gotten there in time to actually catch him while he was in the act and inside, at least they could have he had to walk away and they could have found it.
Even if the alarm, would you still hold the alarm company responsible for all of that?
Well, excuse me. We'll get to that, Your Honor. The alarm company did so many things wrong, including in advance of it. For example, and then they try to lie about it and cover it up.
Even if they did things wrong, it wasn't a causation of injury, so what?
This is a question, Your Honor. Again, I think this is a factual question that can and should be heard by a trier of fact.
person, not your burden, show causation.
Right.
Now, in Dr. Beatry's report, I have read the report, and can you point more, if we're talking about the report that's attached as Exhibit M at pages 1280 to 1285, is that the report? Are we talking about the same report? Is there any other evidence in the record on causation? Is there just one report?
I believe
there are three reports.
Okay. And are they referenced in your briefs?
I believe they are. Standing here right now, I'm not sure I'll be going to be able to actually identify them, but that is something that I can do subsequently and bring forward that part of the report or the reports, because he did examine her three times. He had three different meetings with her.
In terms of causation, though, can we look at it this, like the situation like this? If the alarm had worked perfectly, then don't you have to show that there would be a different result than what happened in this case? And if you can't show that, haven't you not met your burden of causation? I mean, your argument is that she suffered damage because the alarm didn't work. But if the alarm worked perfectly and the same situation would have occurred, police would have come after the robber had left, they couldn't find the robber. How does the failure of the alarm system to work result in damage to your client?
I do believe we have to at least have a minimum showing or make the allegation, but I still believe that the final decision on that as to whether taking into account all of the circumstances is something that a trier of fact, who will have a lot more information available to them.
But even to get to the trier of fact, you have to put forward evidence that a reasonable person could believe had met your burden of proof. If you don't have any evidence, you can't get to the trier of fact.
I believe, Your Honor, and I, standing here right now, it's difficult to actually be able to prove it to you that that the testimony of the police as to what their normal response time would be to an alarm, plus the information that was submitted by Dr. Beatry, together would be available to the trier of fact, who could then make a decision on whether it's more likely than not that the police would have been there in time.
Beside causation, what is the duty of the alarm company to your client? Where does that arise from?
The duty arises from the fact that this was foreseeable. Well, let's just take a look at the contract. The contract itself.
Excuse me, counsel. Before we look at the contract, I want to be really clear. Are you alleging that the tort duty in this case arises strictly out of the contractual relationship between Soto and Lua'a?
It arises first out of the contract and then out of what the contract did not say, because it's ambiguous, and therefore there's a lot of case law showing that under circumstances like this, there a duty is.
But so if I, and I'm just trying to understand, so either the tort duty arises out of the express duty of the contract language, or you're arguing that because the contract language is ambiguous, we should read a contract duty in, which is the foundation for your tort claim. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And you're not alleging that there is an independent tort duty outside of the contract, either clearly in the contract or because of the ambiguity?
Well, it's not just the, well, I guess you could call it three things. It's from the contract, the ambiguity, and because of the law that exists here in Hawaii and in other states that allows the a duty to arise under the overall circumstances of the situation.
Okay, let's focus on door number three here. What Hawaii case law are you relying on to create a duty out of the overall circumstances in this case?
Well, I think first the Doe case.
Okay. And I have read Doe case counsel, and I think Doe case didn't reach the issue of duty, did it? Did it adopt the restatement, or did it say it didn't need to adopt it?
I believe that the cases that the Doe case did reach that, and then the follow-on to the Doe case, there were other cases that interpreted the Doe case, and I believe that they did read it, adopting the language of the restatement.
I believe at the last page of the Doe case it says, therefore, we do not even reach the question of whether Westinghouse should have recognized its contractual duty as necessary for the protection of a third party. So you don't read that to say they didn't reach the issue of duty?
Well, they didn't need to because they based it on the contract and something that was not in the contract.
Do you have any other cases in Hawaii that adopt Section 324A?
Theory of liability. Are you saying that in this case, I know there was some information about the button had been depressed a month earlier and had never been reset, so there was no signal that was transmitted on that date. Is your theory that that's false and that your client pushed the button and there was some malfunction in the system? What's your theory on liability?
Well, first of all, dealing with that, we submitted in a motion for reconsideration when we had all the documents from CMS, who was the actual people who did the monitoring in New York State, that all the information they put about, that the appellees put in concerning the fact that it had been triggered a month before was totally bogus. There was the police didn't get any information about, CMS didn't have any information about, they just created that out of whole cloth. There was nothing to it. Nobody knows for...
Your theory was that the button was ready to go on that day then. And some reason she pressed the button and the signal never got transmitted.
That's correct. Yeah. And she depressed the button three times and no signal ever came through. And nobody ever figured out why. All we got as terms of explanations from the appellees was a series of bogus, created, fraudulent pieces of information. And
so do you think the question of whether the store had agreed with the alarm company that had the button been triggered, that the store would be the one to reset it, you don't think any of that information is relevant to...
Well, it's not just that it isn't relevant, Your Honor. It is relevant in the sense that it shows that the appellees were so frightened and concerned about their liability here that they had to create facts that didn't exist and to mislead everybody in the belief that, well, if they would agree that nothing, that it didn't work, that they would have some liability. I think that's a really important aspect of this to look at, and this is something that I think a trier of fact should be able to review all of the evidence that was put in by both sides and to see what was credible and what's not credible.
Counsel, I have another question on duty. Are you familiar with the 1999 Supreme Court case, Russ Francis versus Lee Enterprise, where the Supreme Court said that courts should avoid creating causes of action that unnecessarily blur the distinction between tort and contract? And that case held that Hawaii law will not allow a recovery in tort in the absence of conduct that violates a duty that is independently recognized by principles of tort law and transcends the breach of contract. I'm wondering why that case doesn't apply here.
Well, I'm not going to suggest that it has no application whatsoever. However, I do think that the fact that this contract is so ambiguous, and I'd like to go through six or seven different ways that the contract is ambiguous, I think allows it to come in here. For example, even in the definition of the system, Soto calls this a hold-up button. Now, they're claiming, well, you can't do anything about hold-up, and it's clearly delineated what the purpose is here, that in case there is a hold-up, somebody's supposed to push something and they'll respond. Then they walk away from that later. They've argued that, we were just trying to protect the candy and the snacks and the sodas and the beer, and it didn't have anything to do with human beings. Then the paragraph number 7 in the contract of payment, they make a big deal out of the fact that there were zeros put in prior to installation and upon completion of installation, as if somehow that meant that there was no obligation that they had to do it. Even in paragraph 9, their disclaimer, does this mean I have to stop?
You're using your rebuttal time, so it's up to you.
Let me just quickly. Paragraphs 9 and 10, that is, each of those paragraphs, they have basically created arguments as to why something should be different from what they said in the contract. And the same with paragraphs 11 and 13.
How does the ambiguity help you? Because both contracting parties suggest that their interpretation of the contract controls if there's an ambiguity. And their interpretation of the contract is that the alarm company is not responsible for the reset and is not informed of this situation. All the contract provides for is that there is a monitoring company that will call the police if the button's depressed.
No, the contract.
So how does ambiguity establish a duty that was established or that extended to your client?
Well, the contract specifically states that they're supposed to contact the police department as well as LOA. And then they say it isn't true, even though it says so in the contract. They put in information that basically tries to walk away from the responsibility that's set forth in this contract and in the CMS contract. I'm not going to use any more of my time right now. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Young.
May it please the court. I'll just answer a few questions. Judge Nakamura had an interesting question about timing. And on the record, it indicates that she was told that if the button was pressed, the police would be there between 3 and 4 minutes. She testified that Rob was there between 2 and 3 minutes. That's on the record. As far as whether they would let any employee would let a strange person in, the door is locked, that's not on the record. There's nothing on the record to indicate that. And again, in terms of Judge Foley's question, there's nothing on the record which would indicate that the police would have arrived timely and the robber would still be there. There's nothing on the record there. You must have heard this a gazillion times, but this really is a simple case. It's a case of duty. And focusing in on the Doe case, which I think Justice Leonard had mentioned, it did reference 324. But the way it explained it was, number one, the person must undertake gratuitously or otherwise, or for consideration, to render services to another. And the key is to another. Who's the other here? And we would submit that given the contractual documents, that the other is not the appellant. I don't want to...
Does that make sense, though? I mean, obviously, if an owner of a store gets an alarm system, in this situation, obviously, to address the situation of robbery, why wouldn't it be makes sense that the owner is trying to protect his or her employees. I'm assuming the owner's not there 24 hours a day, and it's a 24-hour store. So why wouldn't the other in the restatement include employees?
I think it goes to direct benefit. The way I read 324, if I do something, let's say you hire me to do something to help this your brother, and I mess it up, I can be held liable to your brother. In this situation, there's no other intended beneficiary other than General. And that's what we're arguing here. The contractual documents are pretty clear, and I'm not going to rehash them. But just to say that in this situation, there is no third-party beneficiary. And again, that was never pled. It was never brought as a claim in this case. The original complaint did not plead that. But we argued that anyways. So in affirming the court's decision, lower court's decision, we believe the lower court found correctly that there was no duty in this case.
How does the indemnity clause fit into whether or not the parties intended that employees be a third-party beneficiary of the contract?
I think it just shows intent in terms of what the intent of the parties were.
I mean, is there a case law on that? I mean, you could see it go two ways. The fact that you have an indemnity clause in there suggests that there's an acknowledgement that there could be liability to a party outside the contract. So that's why you put the indemnity clause in. On the other hand, the fact that the store owner is saying, look, or the alarm company is saying, hey, I'm not going to pay if anybody else raises a claim under this contract, suggests that at least the alarm company didn't intend a third-party beneficiary situation. But is there case law on how to interpret the indemnity clause in terms of the third-party beneficiary analysis?
We checked that, and there's nothing we could find.
Counsel, at page 14 of your answering brief, you say, quote, the agreement expressly denied third-party beneficiary rights. What express term are you referring to?
I think that would be really bad detail. There's no express exclusion for third-party beneficiary. The argument basically is that the other terms indicate no intent to extend third-party beneficiary rights.
Okay. And again, at page 12, you said, quote, under the express terms of the agreement, appellee did not agree to provide monitoring services that would result in a duty being owed to appellant. Again, I didn't see that express term.
I think that's in terms of the payment, that's my understanding. Paragraph 7 of the contract talks about payment and what would include a monitoring service. And I think it's basically the testimony of the parties indicating that they didn't elect not to.
Okay, but if we're considering testimony of the parties, aren't we considering the contract to be ambiguous at that point?
I don't think so, Your Honor.
Okay, so it's integrated or it's not integrated?
Okay, my understanding is that the parties, that was their intent, but again, Your Honor, it is integrated.
Okay, so then what you're arguing is that we should look at the four squares of the contract and not consider extrinsic evidence, including the testimony.
Your Honor, if the court's going to go to the four corners, then yes.
Okay. What about paragraph 13 of the contract? Does that create any duties to monitor?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. Responsibilities?
Yes.
Only as limited to the contract client. Yes?
Okay, so paragraph 13 creates duties to monitor for Lua'a, but those don't extend to third parties.
That is our argument. Finally, getting back to the Dole case, and I would agree that the Supreme Court did make some, whether it's dicta, but did make some indication of where it might be going. One element missing on the restatement 324 is reliance by appellant, and that reliance caused the harm. There's no evidence in the record to indicate that she relied on any representations made by a
ask you about this, the reset button. Isn't there enough in there to create a factual issue as to whether the button had not been reset or had been reset prior to the incident?
If you're focusing on causation, yes, I would agree with you. But here we're dealing with the issue too.
All right. So in other words, if the button theoretically was, it's not the store owner's fault, so the button was ready to go on the day of the robbery, then obviously there's evidence that nobody got the signal, correct?
That's our information.
Okay. So isn't there a fair inference from that that the alarm malfunctioned on that day?
Malfunction is a different word. Whether it should have been reset or set, I agree, Judge, that would be a question of causation.
All right. So at least there's an issue of fact as to whether the alarm system didn't work on the day that the robbery took place.
I agree, Your Honor. I think that's where the key inquiry here is to.
But even if that was an issue of fact, it wouldn't matter if the plaintiff hadn't met their burden that if the button was pushed and worked, the injury would not have taken
place. Correct. That's an issue that we raised, but I think the foremost issue here is duty and the extended contraction.
So give me the full extent of what the record shows on that causation issue. What's the evidence as to the timing of when the police would likely have arrived and the timing of the robbery?
The robber was in there 2 or 3 minutes, as I indicated, according to Zaragoza's testimony, Telvis testimony. She was told that the police arrived 3 to 4 minutes after the button was pressed. There was nothing in the record to indicate how long the police would have gotten there. There's nothing in the record on that.
Counsel, did Dr. Batui in his report say what appellant said he said, which is that it was the failure of the police to come as opposed to the robbery incident itself that caused the...
I'm sorry, I did not brief that particular issue. It's not in our brief that I...
Right.
On the record, I didn't...
Are there three reports in the record in this case of Dr. Batui?
I only know of one, but I have never seen the other two myself.
Okay.
But is there a recollection that report was proffered in response to the summary judgment motion?
But I don't think it was a summary judgment. I don't know. I didn't brief that issue.
Well, can you articulate, just so we're clear, what your grounds are for alleging that there's no genuine issue of material fact as to causation in this case?
I would submit that if you get to the issue of causation, then it might be a question of fact. And that's why I'm saying the primary inquiry here is duty. Whether duty exists. And whether that can be extended on a third-party beneficiary basis.
Right, but if the contract can be read to be ambiguous, then extrinsic evidence can be used to figure out what the intent of the parties was. And in this case, did the store owner say in a deposition that he intended to protect his employees through the obtaining of this alarm system?
No.
Was there some testimony on that? I seem to recall that there was evidence about the store owner indicating that one of his purposes was to protect store owners by getting the system.
I believe that came from the plaintiff, her testimony. But as far as my recollection of the testimony of Hubin, I think who was the LOA technical person, that wasn't raised.
So there was no evidence from the store, the contracting party, as to what the intent was with respect to this particular alarm system.
That's correct.
All right. Maybe answer one question for me. Just factually, I didn't understand. There was some evidence that they chose a button that, when depressed, would remain depressed and had to be reset before it would work again, versus a wireless system where you could continually press the button and it would reset automatically. And the explanation was because the employer wanted to know who pressed the button.
Why
does that make any sense? Why couldn't you tell in the wireless system when the button was depressed, the employee who was working at that time must have pressed it?
Yeah, I mean, from my understanding of the two systems is that the system which was selected was a system similar to what they already had, so the employees would be familiar with it. I think that's a good far as making a difference as to why there are false alarms, that wasn't really gotten into in deposition or discovered in terms of the technical aspects of the alarm system.
So you don't know why they would choose a button that had to be manually reset versus one that would reset automatically?
I don't know why, but from the testimony that's on the record, it appears that they were concerned about false alarms. That's only on the record. That's all there is in the record.
As to some of the cases that you had asked about, one of them we had, it's in the record, is the matter of King versus Ilikai Properties, a 1981 case. And the Court of Appeals noted that whether a duty exists is a question of fairness that involves weighing of the nature of the risk, the magnitude of the burden, guarding against the risk, and the public's interest in the proposed solution. And also went on to say that, and the burden of guarding against the risk, that risk is a matter of defendant living up to the terms of the contract that it agreed upon and for which it also received monthly payments. And so it would also contend that the safety and the welfare of the employees and customers of a convenience store. Now, this what I'm saying now, the second part, is not in the case. It's the argument based upon that. And in the Doe case, I think we understand that they're quoting 325A, that they recognize the necessity for the protection of a third person or things is subject to liability to the third persons for physical harm. We'd also like to point out that the expectation of protection was created in the appellant because she was told by her employer, Loa, that...
Doesn't that make it a claim against her employer? And doesn't she have a claim against her employer under workers' compensation or...
That's all past.
Right. But I mean, why is the fact that the employer made a statement somehow attributable to the alarm company?
I think it is significant in the following respect, that I don't believe that the employer would have made that kind of a statement unless the employers believed in good faith based upon their contracting with the SODO, the appellees. There would be no other reason for them to make that statement unless they believed in good faith that in fact was true.
But you're using that to create a duty on the part of a party that never made a statement.
Well, I'm using it for that purpose. I'm also using it to talk about the state of mind and what was a reasonable expectation of, let's say, a third party beneficiary.
LE argued that restatement clause is limited and it only applies to representations or actions that go directly to, in this case, the store owner, not the store owner's employees. Do you have a case involving an alarm company in which the restatement has been applied to create liability for the alarm company vis-a-vis the employee as opposed to the contractor?
Well, there are actually a couple of cases here, Gardner versus Vincent, which is 538 Southern. It's the second, it's a 1988 case where an implied duty was owed to the victim even though the contract between the security company and her employer was not for the protection of the employees. And it's also the Gold Mills Inc. versus Orbit Possessing Corporation, which is a 297 Atlantic 2nd. It's a 1972 case. Then there's a more recent case supporting our position. It's Elizabeth E. versus ADT. security systems. It's a 108 Nevada Pacific Second. It's a 92 case where an employee was told to press a silent alarm button if confronted by an intruder, but after doing so, the signal failed to reach the security company. Although the employer did not contract for monitoring services, the court held that the misrepresentation by the security company that it would monitor the alarm system created a foreseeable expectation of service, and the employer relied upon the security company when faced with an actual emergency. So I think those are significant matters for the court to take into account. There's also on the foreseeability matter, there's the McGuire case, which is McGuire versus Hilton Hotel, which is a Hawaii Supreme Court case, where the High Court state clarified its ruling in the Doe case. That is, this followed on to the Doe case. And this is, that the site on this is 899 Pacific 2nd, 393. Basically, it said in McGuire, the court reversed and remanded a summary judgment ruling in favor of the defendant based on the duty owed by Hilton, which had a special relationship established between the parties but was not delineated in the 314A restatement of torts, and the foreseeability of criminal behavior by a third party. The court found that, quote, exceptions to the general rule that there is no duty to protect against, to protect another against a criminal act of a third party may arise when justified by the existence of some special relationship between the parties. The court then explains that this duty is imposed on landowners as a result of the price that they must pay for the economic benefit derived as a result of them doing business.
If the duty that you referred to is derived from the contract, why doesn't the limited damages provision of the contract also apply?
Well, even the limit of damages is interesting because the paragraph that apparently is supposed to liquidate the damages, it says that it's six times the effective monthly payment hereunder or the sum of, and it was left blank. So there's an issue of fact here. It makes it ambiguous because there was no number put in there.
That as meaning that it's unlimited now?
No, I'm just saying it creates yet another ambiguity, another question that arises here.
That's an issue of fact?
Well, I believe it. Well, it's an issue. It's definitely an issue. The fact that the contracting party simply failed to, among the many ambiguities, is the fact that it isn't stated there.
But do you believe that clause would apply? In other words, if that clause is interpreted as meaning that it's limited to $600 or $300, five times, six times the $50 monthly fee, why not, though? I'm asking you whether, if the duty is derived from the contract, why wouldn't a limited damages clause of the contract apply to any claim made?
Well, I...
You're saying that clause is ambiguous, but I'm saying, does it apply? And if it's read to be unambiguous or to limit it to $300, does it apply in this case?
I don't think so.
Why not?
Because what was implied in this, one of the other ambiguities is whether personal injuries were covered, and that's very ambiguous. Because of the paragraph 19, the third party indemnification, which implies that there could be personal injuries and other injuries beyond that. I simply don't think that applies because of all the ambiguities involved here. And I don't think that should be taken as the only, as a direct limitation.
The contract was not ambiguous. Would clauses in the contract that limited damages apply?
If it had been specific and it had said something that involved personal injury, if personal injury had been covered or if other kinds of damage issues had been covered and it was specific and clear and direct, I think it's possible that it could apply.
Thank you, Counsel. Your time is up. We'll take that under advisement. Thank you, Counsel.